On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It is Farm Bill time again in Washington, and once again, American farms and wastelines and economics and trade are all on the line. If you are what you eat, the massive bill being cooked up in Congress right now is fundamental. It decides what we grow. Its enormous farm subsidies help determine if Twinkies will be cheaper than greens and Coke cheaper than carrot juice. Critics want a farm bill revolution for American diets and health and trade. Defenders say be careful you don't wreck the amber waves of grain. Up next on Point, the farm bill on Capitol Hill and the food in our mouths. We will hear in this hour from Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, who's talking reform, from North Carolina Congressman Bob Etheridge, who's not, and from muckraking food supply writer Michael Pollan. But first, joining us from Washington, D.C., Philip Brasher, reporter for the Des Moines Register. He's been following the latest news on the Farm Bill and how its politics are playing out in the Capitol and the Farm Belt. Philip Brasher, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, thank you, Tom.
So, on the one hand, we're talking about revolution. On the other hand, we hear people are already digging in their heels. Positions are pretty well set. Is it all over but the shouting, Philip?
Oh, not by any means. It's just starting. It is quite clear. You talk about the people who've benefited from this program. They very much would like the status quo. They'd like things to stay the same. This program has since enacted in 2002, has been very popular with the grain and cotton farms that primarily benefits.
Corn, beans, wheat, rice, and cotton, the big targets
exactly,
for these subsidies.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Midwest and the South. So.
What kind of money are we talking about over the last 5 years, Philip?
Well, it's anywhere from all the way up to as much as $20 billion a year. And a couple of years ago, the corn growers alone got about $10 billion in subsidies out of this program. Iowa got a very large share of that. And that's, I have to say, in the last year or two, prices for a range of almost all commodities mm-hmm. have gone up significantly. In many cases, well above the rates that trigger subsidies. So the amount of money going out from the government has dropped considerably in the last year or two.
When prices go up, the cost to the taxpayer, to the government, drops?
Yes, but it's important to understand that the reason those prices have gone up is because of the demand for corn and the demand of acreage for corn to make ethanol. And ethanol, of course, is a market and a industry that is driven by government policy itself.
Right. Also booming right there. Big requirements for a lot more ethanol on the market in just a few years. Describe the politics of this for us, Philip. We see some sort of surprising stripes here. Some Midwestern politicians and others very strong for the status quo. Others, Richard Lugar in Indiana, Congressman Kind in Wisconsin, and to some extent Tom Harkin talking reform. Can ag state politicians really be for reform of the farm bill?
Well, you have to say that Dick Lugar in Indiana has always favored more of a free market farm policy, and Indiana has a bit more of a free market approach to agriculture. They have a little different mix of agriculture than some other states, big tomato processing industry
right.
that they've had historically. Senator Harkin from Iowa is chairman of Senate Agriculture Committee and is going to be a major player in this. He has long been a supporter of moving some agricultural subsidies into a conservation program that would, some people describe it as a green payment type program, where you pay farmers on the basis of the environmental, the conservation, the farming practices that they're mm-hmm. undertaking that conserve soil, use fewer pesticides, and so forth. This is he started a program to do this in 2002. It has not gotten a lot of funding since then, and is a fairly small program. He would like to put a lot more money into that. There is more support for that in states like Iowa because of the conservation issues that are involved, the pollution running off of.
Right, so we've got chemical runoff, right. Environmental issues,
exactly.
Of course, the economy in the middle of this, and trade very large here. Lamentations from abroad that farmers in poor countries can't make a go of it because they get overwhelmed by subsidized and therefore lower price American agricultural commodities. In the run-up to a presidential election year, Philip Brasher, can anybody really change this? Or if they go at it hammer and tongs, do they risk losing the votes and the electoral college votes of these key farm states?
Well, they will have to play it very carefully because a state like Iowa is going to be very important, not just in the caucuses, but also in the president in a close presidential election. Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, those three states in particular have been swing states. In the last two elections, you saw Bush pay a tremendous amount of attention to Iowa and Minnesota, for example, and Wisconsin.
Sure, Bush and now
2000 and 2004.
Yeah, Bush and now a whole lot of other people as well. Philip, thanks for getting us started on the conversation. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay.
Philip Brasher with the Des Moines Register joining us there from Washington, D.C. Joining us right now from Berkeley, California, is Michael Pollan, well-known environmental journalist. He's written a lot about the Farm Bill and how it goes to the very sort of fundament of our diets, our economy, our lives. He's a journalism professor at the University of California, Berkeley, most recently author of The Omnivore's Dilemma. Michael Pollan, thanks very much for being with us today.
Sure, Tom. Good to be here.
We're going to hear in a few minutes from Senator Tom Harkin and from Congressman Bob Etheridge, of North Carolina. They both got big stakes in this. You're not a politician. You're looking at it from the outside as a kind of critic and maybe a cheerleader for some revolution here. What do you see at stake in the Farm Bill, Michael?
Well, I think a lot is at stake. I mean, I think we have a food system that's really broken. And the first thing to remember that this isn't just a farm bill. This is not just a piece of parochial legislation mm-hmm. about farmers. It really affects all of us and in many profound ways. And the fact that the system is broken, and there's plenty of evidence for that. We have a public health crisis around food in this country, an epidemic of obesity and diabetes that's traceable to cheap, unhealthy calories that are generated by a farm bill subsidizing the crops you mentioned, corn and soybeans in particular.
Michael, paint that sort of chain of sequence there. How do you get from a farm bill to obese Americans?
Well, it's pretty straightforward. Basically, if you're structuring the rules of your food system, and that's really what the Farm Bill does, in such a way that you're encouraging farmers to overproduce certain kinds of crops and not others, we subsidize these grain crops, we don't subsidize fruits and vegetables,
mm-hmm.
you're going to put a lot of cheap sweeteners in the form of things like high fructose corn syrup and cheap fats in the form of the soy oil that all our junk food is fried in,
mm-hmm.
You're going to make those calories abundant and cheap. And when those calories are abundant and cheap, people eat more of them. And that's, if you go back to the 1970s, where we really changed the rules of the game to encourage this sort of overproduction, that is also when American farmers started producing another 600 calories per person per day, 200 of which we're managing to eat additionally since then, and that's really when the obesity epidemic strikes. So there is a direct line between the way you the incentives you have in your food system and the kinds of food that's available in the grocery store and the kinds of food people eat.
And we end up with fat kids and fat Americans right across the country. There may be other elements to that, but the food supply is critically...
It's one. Oh, it's not. It's certainly not the only cause, but it's the baseline cause, which is too many unhealthy calories.
How could we do it differently, Michael? If this is the basic structure, if there were going to be an alternative, was talk of revolution, what would that look like?
Well, it begins with, I don't think that supporting farmers is a bad idea, and I'm not in favor of a free market approach necessarily, but I think we have to re-examine the way we support farmers, whether we're paying them to produce more and more, or paying them to take care of the land, or providing other incentives to encourage farmers to grow more than corn and soybeans and wheat. I'm not a policymaker, and there are smarter people than me. I mean, people like Senator Harkin, who are devising the mechanisms that might give us a food system that puts healthier food in the supermarkets. We have to look at the whole. We know the best thing we can do for our health is to eat more fruits and vegetables. Why aren't we doing anything to help people produce that more cheaply. The price of fruits and vegetables has gone up 40% in the last decade or two, while the price of added sweeteners and fat has gone down 13%.
So soda pop and junk food down almost a quarter.
So the challenge for the policymakers is figure out a way to level the playing field between the healthy calories we all know we should be eating and the unhealthy calories that we should be eating less of. And it's not the answer is not simply to subsidize fruit and vegetable growers. I don't think you don't want an overproduction of broccoli either. It's
right.
Going to rot in the field.
Right.
But you can do all sorts of things to encourage demand for those things with programs for the poor that give them vouchers that they can redeem in farmers' markets. Food stamps now are redeemed with a credit card-like device, which is hard to use in a farmers' market since they're not wired. So why not wire farmers' markets so people can take their food stamp money there?
We've been talking with Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma. He joins us from Berkeley, California. Right now, from the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., we're joined by Senator Tom Harkin, chairman of the Senate Agricultural Committee, of course, one of Iowa's senators in Washington. Senator Harkin, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, Tom, it's nice to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We're hearing all kinds of noise out of the Bush administration saying that what Congress is cooking up is not reform. Mike Johann, Secretary of Agriculture, it's not reform. That's pretty straightforward, he says. Are we going to get something different, Senator?
Well, I'm trying to fashion a bill that will have some reforms. I mean, if you're looking for a very sharp turn of this big ship called farm policy, it won't happen. But we can nudge it in different directions. When I was chairman in 2002, on the Senate side, I tried to get it nudged in a different direction by sort of adopting what Europe had done before. I traveled all over Europe and looked at their farms. And what they've done is they are paying farmers not for what they grow or how much they grow, but for how they grow it. And I started that program. It's called the Conservation Security Program. I think Michael Pollan may have mentioned it. I
listened
a little bit there.
Yep.
And that's the idea, is to start paying farmers to be good conservationists, to protect the soil and the water, not to overload the fertilizer, to keep our waters clean, to provide for wildlife habitat. But the administration and the Republican Congress in the past have been trying to destroy the program. They took $2.9 billion out of that program over the last 4 years. But I must say this, Mike Johanns, Secretary Johanns, went around the country last year. He came back, and now he's a supporter of this program, and the administration is asking for more funding and, of course, to streamline it. So we do have some hopes that we can move in that direction.
When you move to a conservation focus in some degree, is that a fundamental change, Senator, or is that kind of nibbling around the edges? Will that really change the profile of what American farmers produce overall?
Well, as I said, you know, this ship's been going down one sort of direction for a long time, and it takes a long time to turn it. But because of the WTO and our obligations under the World Trade Organization, we do have to change some of the ways we're doing things. But it takes a while to change it, and I recognize that. And so fundamental change, I don't think so, but it's moving it in a different direction. That's why I also want to put more emphasis in this bill on capping payments, in cutting down on some of the direct payments that go to these big wealthy farmers, and taking that money and putting it into rural development, into energy, providing for more promotion of energy crops, which are conserving in nature, and also for conservation. So, you know, those are some of the things we're looking at. Plus, we're going to do more in nutrition. I think it's time that we take a look at the food stamp program and start providing bonuses to people on food stamps for buying fruits and vegetables.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we're going to try some pilot programs in that direction.
And, of course, food stamps, part of this giant bill as well. You know, I grew up a farm kid. Nobody wants to stick it in the farmer's ear. I remember how much difference those checks from the government made, but the picture of the small farmer being dependent on this seems now kind of eclipsed by the picture of great big agribusiness doing this. And now along comes the ethanol boom, and I think people are asking, Senator, whether if there's going to be new value in agricultural crops in their use as fuel, maybe we don't need to subsidize as much anymore. We've seen prices go up.
Well, I think we're on the cusp of a new round of energy. So far, we've been using corn to make ethanol. It's been very good. We'll probably continue to use more for a while. But really what I want to do in this farm bill is to provide some impetus to move towards cellulose production of ethanol. And with cellulose production, that can be very conserving, and we can actually grow the kind of crops that are in many ways native to the areas of the country.
Prairie grasses, switchgrass, that kind of thing.
Exactly, which have long roots, which sequester carbon. You get a lot of win-win-wins out of this and in moving towards cellulose production. Or, for example, we have to move off of the old cotton program that we've had in the South. I know that, but you can't just pull the rug out from underneath them. So we need to transition them into, let's say, growing wood pulp and wood trees, sugar cane in some areas, for energy crops in the South. That can be a whole new level of production, a whole new agriculture for different areas of the country.
Mm. Senator, we've got callers from your home state. Let's take one. Michael, calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Michael, you're on the air with Senator Tom Harkin.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. I work in the ethanol industry. I'm on my way to an ethanol plant right now.
Yep.
I have my training in environmental science, and I just want to echo the senator's initial statements to say that whatever farm bill we do initially craft, the final product needs to be sustainable. The ethanol industry itself is a piece of that puzzle, but it in itself has little sustainability built into it right now. And the switchgrass and cellulose ethanol is a great idea, but along with fuel cells, it's somewhat down the road. And I would appreciate any work the senator could do to help these things become reality.
Michael, are you saying don't rock the boat too much?
I'm saying the boat needs to be rocked, and instead of nudging us in the right direction, we all need to grab the wheel and yank.
Okay. Okay, we hear it. Let us pick that up. Michael Pollan, you hear our caller from Cedar Rapids. You've heard Senator Tom Harkin. Are we nudging hard enough here? I mean, we're talking about the next maybe half decade of American agricultural policy.
Well, we're talking about the next 5 years, and I think the Farm Bill has, response to could respond to some stronger yanking. I think Senator Harkin is up against some very powerful forces. And the reason, though, that it's so hard to move the farm bill is because you really don't have most of the rest of the country paying that much attention, at least in the past. And so that farm state legislators wield a disproportionate influence
mm-hmm.
over a bill that affects everybody. And when I think you find people in the cities and people on the coasts starting to realize that they have a stake as eaters, as parents, in the farm bill, you will have a different set of politics. I think we're seeing signs of that this year for the first time in a long time, but we need a lot more of that.
Mm.
You know, you can break this kind of logjam very quickly with citizen politics.
Mm.
So when people start writing their representatives, many of whom are simply giving away or trading their votes on farm policy to the people on the committees, you will see some change.
Senator Harkin, let me ask you, can you do right by your state, Iowa, and by the whole country and its health and its diet in the same bill here?
Well, I absolutely think so. I don't think there's that much of a conflict. I think, again, as Michael and others said, I think we do need to make changes. I hope our bill in the Senate will reflect some good, solid reforms. How much I can get through, he's right. I'm up against some very powerful forces, no doubt about it. But again, you know, changes come perhaps in small increments. I would say, however, that there's a lot of other facets of this bill that we need to pay attention to. I started a program in 2002 called the Fruit and Vegetable Snack Program in school.
Mm-hmm.
My idea was to give free fresh fruits and vegetables to kids in school, not just during the lunch hour, but when they got hungry. They could go get a piece of fruit or vegetable or whatever, free. My theory was that they would eat them. They wouldn't be eating junk food. They wouldn't get sugar highs and sugar lows. They'd be better students. And you want to know something?
Mm.
We started with 4 states and 100 schools. We're now up to 14 states and about 450 schools. Not one school that's participated in this program has asked to drop out. Every single one says it's one of the best things they've ever had. My goal in this farm bill is to expand this. My goal is in 10 years from now, every elementary school kid in America will have free fresh fruits and vegetables.
So bring on the carrots, and they must love that in California and the truck farms of New Jersey. Does Iowa care?
Sure they care. They care about our kids and the health of our kids. I'm telling you, the schools that have had this in Iowa think it's wonderful. And, you know, more and more, we're also, you look at organics. I'm going to do more in our farm bill for organic farmers. It's a big demand in this country. Whole Foods is now importing organics because we can't supply the market here. Well, that's nonsense. We can supply the market here. And there's a lot of farmers in Iowa and other places who would like to do a little bit more in organics, but they don't have the support to do so. Well, we're going to put that support in this farm bill.
Senator Tom Harkin joining us today from Washington. Senator, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Let me turn now to Raleigh, North Carolina, and Congressman Bob Etheridge. He's chairman of a key ag subcommittee in the House that oversees farm subsidies. They voted last month to continue, basically continue the 2002 bill as is in 07. Congressman Etheridge, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Good being with you.
So there's a lot of talk about reform, about revolution, but you're sort of standing up here, well, actually very hard standing up for the status quo. Why?
Well, the status quo is not a correct word, Tom. What we did, the Ag Committee, along with our subcommittee, held somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 hearings from the West Coast to the East Coast, from the Canadian border to the Mexican border, and throughout America.
Mm-hmm.
We listened to the producers, to farmers, and to consumers. Here's what we heard from them. What we have, we like. The program has worked. It has literally saved the taxpayers about $17 billion over the last few years using what is called a three-legged stool. The three-legged stool consists of direct payments, counter-cyclical payments, which means if the market goes down, you know, they get a certain payment. So the product prices, they don't go broke, or marketing loan payments. So if you store your materials for a while, then you can sell them. And it has worked. It has saved the taxpayers. Now, does there need to be change? Sure. But do you need to go in and make wholesale change and start over? When a program is working, you know, most times people say, what do we need to change it to make it better, rather than how do we go in with a meat axe and start all over?
I hear
we
that
tried
perspective.
That
yep.
in the, wait a minute, let me
yep.
finish.
Yes, sir.
We tried that in the mid-90s with what was called Freedom to Farm.
Dick Lugar's plan.
And the federal government put more money in disaster payments than we've spent since then. So what we need to do is make the adjustments to fit the time, but not go in because commodity prices are high, assuming they will never go down again. We did that in the 90s. We did it in the 80s. And every time we do it without a safety net, everyone pays to include the person that goes to the dairy counter and to the grocery shelf.
But we've got an obesity problem. We've got trade problems now overseas. A lot of people looking at those subsidies.
Sure.
After you came up with this bill, the Secretary of Agriculture, Mike Johann, says it's not reform. That's pretty straightforward. I'm looking here at ag economist Dan Sumner. He says if you're looking for a signal that the U.S. is serious about negotiating lower farm supports, this bill, the one you've led here, is basically saying to heck with you.
Well, what happens in the EU, direct payments are acceptable and expected. And that's the very issue that some are talking about. I mean, the European Union is paying direct subsidy payments to farmers. What we're saying is do it in a three-phase, make the changes that are necessary. We're going to have some changes in the final bill that comes through. We will start the markup tomorrow. Yes, there will be some adjustments. There will be changes. And I think that's appropriate. But the changes have to be changes that will work. Will there be more money for conservation? Absolutely, and there should be. Why? But the problem we face, Tom, is a problem that is not of our making. Part of it is because we saved the money, the $17 billion over the last 5 years. We lose our baseline, which means we have far less money than we did when we wrote the 02 Farm Bill.
So use it, spend it or lose it.
And, you know, we got to use the dollars we got. We're putting more in conservation. There will be less in some of the other commodity areas.
Congressman Bob Etheridge of North Carolina, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Pleasure being with you.
Let's take a call from Dawn in Providence, Rhode Island. Dawn, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I read Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and I loved it. But it did leave me feeling a little bit frustrated, especially in the sections where he discusses the lack of sustainability in industrial organic agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, as a consumer, what is the best thing for us to do to break this cycle in our food system, in the farm system that's broken? What can we do to help make it healthier?
Don, thanks for that. Michael Pollan, you hear Congressman Etheridge basically saying more of the same. At least that's how the Agriculture Secretary characterizes it. Then you've got a consumer like Don who says, I want change. How do I get it?
Yeah, well, I think you see right there the two points on a very wide spectrum. There are a lot of people who want to see change, and they want to see more radical change. And farm policy is part of that change. But, of course, there is a lot that the consumer can do. I want to address some of Etheridge's comments, but it is possible as consumers today, we have a lot of alternatives. We can check out on this supermarket industrial food system and take our dollars elsewhere. And it starts with, I think, shopping locally in your farmer's market, joining something like a CSA, a community-supported agriculture scheme, where you get a weekly box of produce from a farmer, and just move those dollars to building this alternative farm economy.
But that's not necessarily easy to do. Not everybody has access to a farmer market at the time that they're, let's say, off work and ready to shop. It's the supermarket sitting there that's got the main line of American food in it.
It does have the main line today, but it's changing. There are between 4,000 and 5,000 farmers markets now. It's the fastest growing corner of the food system. So there are parts of the country where farmers markets are not open every week, obviously, and that they're very seasonal. But when they are, if you spend your money there, you are building up this. You're participating in reform too. You can vote with your fork as well as with your votes, and you really need to do both. In terms of the subsidy issue, I think what's happening here is that the House is staking out a position against Harkin's position, and this is all coming down to a negotiation that'll happen in conference committee between the House and Senate. So the House basically seeing that even the administration wants reform, the Senate wants reform, that if they're going to have any sway, they want to put down a marker, and it's a very conservative, retrograde marker, which is leave it the same. As you were getting at in your question, Tom, basically our subsidy system, to continue this system that's supposedly working, it is illegal under WTO rules. It has been ruled so in the case of cotton subsidies,
yep.
And the same logic would apply to all the others. That and to cite the EU as a model, I mean, they are in violation also of world trade rules.
We're talking this hour about the new farm bill coming up through Congress and how it will shape the food we eat and the country we are. Michael Pollan is with us. He's author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, really a great book if you want to get behind the scenes of the American food system. We're joined right now as well from Washington by Jake Caldwell. He's Director of Policy for Agriculture, Trade, and Energy at the Center for American Progress, law professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. Jake Caldwell, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Tom.
There's an angle we haven't touched much, and it has to do with trade. There's a great hue and cry from poorer countries and from relief organizations around the world saying, America, change your farm policy. Why?
Well, at the international level, the sticking point in international trade negotiations at the World Trade Organization has been the farm policy of the United States, and specifically our subsidy policy and the policies of the European Union, as you mentioned.
What's the basic argument, the basic critique?
The basic critique is that our subsidies encourage production, which causes the price of commodities to fall, and that not only hurts our farmers here at home and sort of shooting ourselves in the foot, but it also really has a huge impact on developing country farmers. And it's important to remember that in developing countries, in the poorest countries of the world, 70% of the population lives in rural areas, is involved in agriculture. Agriculture is an important stepping stone on the economic ladder out of poverty, and it's a huge part of their gross domestic product.
Michael Pollan, I've read maybe from you about all the connections and web here. If you want to look at why Mexicans are coming north across the American border, maybe it's in part because of all the cheap corn going to Mexico, sort of undercut a lot of farmers there for a while. And then with the ethanol boom, corn prices skyrocket and suddenly they don't have the capacity, but their tacos are costing a lot because corn gets expensive again.
Yeah, Mexico's really been whipsawed. It's a very good illustration of what Jake's describing, which is the fact that when we start dumping agricultural commodities that on world markets that we're selling beneath the cost of production, because the subsidies allow the farmers to do that, this collapses agricultural markets in other places. And what happened in Mexico after NAFTA, when they started taking this flood of cheap subsidized American corn, is more than 2 million agricultural workers and farmers in Mexico were thrown out of work and off the land. And a great many of them flowed north. And people who had been corn farmers in southern Mexico ended up as serfs on American fruit and vegetable farms in the West Coast. So that, you know, all these things are connected. And if we export too much cheap agricultural commodities, we're going to reap the whirlwind, which is global poverty and more immigration. And so we have to recognize that the decisions we're making are not just about supporting some corn farmer in Iowa, but these policies ramify all over the world, and that we need to take account of that in drawing these policies, or we will find ourselves, you know, at odds with organizations like the World Trade Organization and others.
And even if you care more about that corn farmer in Iowa than the one in Mexico, the problem may still end up in your lap, as the Mexico story indicates. Let's take a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Dan, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
Here's what I did to help solve the problem for me in Nashville.
Okay.
I bought a piece of land 10 years ago, learned how to grow food from the biggest organic farmer, became his driver, started his first CSA. Then I networked and organized farmers. There's now 20, 25 CSAs in Nashville.
CSA, this is what's a CSA again, Dan?
It's a community-sponsored agriculture project. And I also built the health food store in East Nashville. So I went on the way home. It takes me 5 minutes to shop. And I get food that comes from cow farms, chicken farms, eggs, everything from right around here within 50 miles of Nashville.
So you've just made your own reality happen there. So does the farm bill matter to you or not?
Well, I don't believe that the government and the corporate policies will be the answer. They'll follow if the market turns toward niche marketing, which is what we have in the music business now. It's niche marketing, and I'm saying that food can become a niche for a while, and then the corporation will figure out that they got to keep growing regional food, and they need to grow it more organically so it'll be more substantial and have more nutrients. And lead. Let those people follow. That's what they need to do.
So you're voting with your fork and your feet and the sweat of your brow there on a different path. Dan, thanks for that. Jake Caldwell, what about it? Here we're subsidizing, and the numbers show subsidizing a lot of very large agribusiness entities with the Farm Bill. Can, you know, smaller operators like Dan really make a difference, or does the Farm Bill have to pave the way for a change in our agricultural profile?
Well, I think certainly at the Center for American Progress, you know, we believe that farmers like Dan deserve a bigger share of this pie. You know, what we're concerned about was, and we've talked about, is you listen to Senator Harkin and you listen to Congressman Etheridge, is the sheer breadth and scope of this massive bill, the conservation programs, the good things that Senator Harkin has said about capping subsidy payments, mm-hmm. the potential on energy and rural development. But 57% of U.S. farmers receive no payments. 8% of these farms, of the payments, go to 58% of the, the top big dogs get most of the money in this scenario.
And that's because they're so big in the grains that are subsidized, corn, beans, rice, wheat, and of course cotton, or?
Cotton, soybeans. It's the domination of those big commodities, and that's sort of the entrenched status quo that we're up against. I mean, there's been recent research that showed that we are paying out $1.3 billion over the last 5 years to farmers who don't even farm. That's just based on historical usage. But just very quickly, back on the trade point, in terms of, I mean, we're under the gun already, as Senator Harkin has noted and Congressman Etheridge noted, in terms of we have been challenged by the Canadians on our corn subsidies. We've been challenged last week, by the Brazilians again, following up on their cotton case. Now they're challenging our complete subsidy program. So it seems to us that we have a choice here. We can sort of get proactive, get involved, sort of define our own destiny here on farm policy, or we can just throw up our hands and say it's too difficult and we have to go slow.
But then it will happen in some kind of international tribunal, or could. Let me ask you then, Michael Pollan looks at what's happened in the House, the kind of same old that's been put forward by Congressman Etheridge, and says this is just a negotiating position. When they get to the Senate, there's going to be a lot of, or some action anyway. How far do you imagine the Farm Bill could move this time around? If this is going to be it for another another 5 years. What's your read on the real politics in Washington now? Jake?
On the real politics, I think Michael and Phil Bratcher earlier put it very well in terms of we are setting ourselves up for a grand conflagration of a negotiation between the House and the Senate. And I really hope that the folks, that people realize that the priorities of all Americans are tied up in this bill, and that the final product should reflect a little bit more the priorities
of
most.
But do you see the votes for change here, or is it going to come back down, particularly in the ramp to a presidential election year, to caution on those farm state votes where, you know, people may not want that change?
I think the forces of the entrenched status quo that are against any change, that are against this farm bill reflecting adjustments to fit the time, as Congressman Etheridge said, I think, and I'm not saying he's in this camp, but I think that they take a huge risk if they go to the floor of the House without proposing more reform than they've put forward at this stage. And I think they're at risk for a general debate, and I hope a wide debate with constituents on this issue and where to take this country in the future, on farm policy, on energy policy, on conservation policy, and nutrition policy, food stamps, all these things that this bill affects.
That is an amazing swath. Let's take another call from Dyersville, Iowa. Robert, you're on the air.
Well, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm calling on behalf of the small farmers. And I see this farm bill, it's the large proportion of the money's going towards the amount of corn you produce, and it's not on a need basis. So you get money for buying farms, and like consolidating and corporations, and the small farmer gets squeezed out, in which 40% of the farms have gone under to foreclosure or having to sell their land to large farm corporations.
And you see the farm bills historically pushing that dynamic of the big fish gobbling up the little ones.
Yeah, and it's killing rural Iowa, rural Wisconsin, Illinois, and you know, towns are just evaporating, and I think it's ridiculous how the government just sells out to agribusiness, Tyson Meats, and stuff like that.
And so what do you want? Can you see a farm bill that would help the small farmer? Do you have a particular policy change in mind, Robert?
Well, instead of giving money towards the amount of food you produce, do it on a need basis, or Harkin's got something right where, you know, the small farmer can get their money by, you know, no-till or organic farming, conserving the land.
Right. Robert, good luck to you, and thanks for the advice there. Let's get another call from Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska. Miller's on the line. Hi, Miller, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Well, you know, I live in Missoula, Montana, and I've just been watching a lot of this stuff going on, and I really sort of caught on to your conversation. I think it's very important stuff. It's, like, unbelievable, and it's hard sometimes to recognize it, but One policy change that sort of came to me would be to allow food to be sold in more areas, more, you know, downtown. You know, I don't know, have areas where you can sell local food.
I mean, have more farmers market access, open up parks or parking lots, you name it.
That's just an idea that just came to me, but, you know, it's getting the food into the streets, getting it to people is, I don't know, it's cool when it happens. You're eating great produce, and, like, it's a beautiful thing. Anyway.
Miller, we like the advice, and we hear a kind of a groundswell in that direction. Thanks very much for calling in from Lincoln, Nebraska there. Let's get a call from Lee, New Hampshire. Ted, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom, for taking the call.
Yeah.
So I think that the consumer actually has a lot more responsibility than what we're sharing. I believe, and I'd like to hear some responses,
mm-hmm.
Does the government have to subsidize more because the farmers don't actually get the fair share of the dollar that they deserve? I was just reading the other day in the Boston Globe that Massachusetts has to pay out, I think it's $2.3 billion into 180 different dairy farms because they're not getting, they're only getting 50% of the retail, actually 40%, which used to be 50% of the retail price.
Mm-hmm.
So the consumers may really do need to pay more.
Ted, are you in the farm? Are you a farmer? What's your role here?
I'm a chef in a restaurant, and I am on a core group of a small 2-acre organic CSA. So I buy a lot from the local farms for our restaurant and for my family as well. And we do pay a lot more. pound for pound, but we have a better quality of food. It lasts longer. It looks better. It tastes better. And what we see at the grocery store is, factory-farmed vegetables, and it's not my standards.
Right. There's the chef's view, and it's a strong one. Ted, thanks for that. Michael Pollan, what about it?
Yeah,
two things. Do we need subsidies, number one? And number two, do consumers need to sort of brace themselves to pay more for better food?
Well, you do get what you pay for in food and everything else. We seem to understand that if you pay good money for a car, you're going to get a better car. We don't seem to have the same ethic when it comes to food, and we need to develop that ethic, no question about it. But, I think the caller is onto something. We don't need subsidies, but we do need to support farmers, and there are other ways to do it. You know, we could have the equivalent of a minimum wage for farmers so that, in fact, they're guaranteed the cost of production, say, and then that would become the safety net. And then the cost would be passed on to the people buying the produce. The great beneficiaries of the subsidy system are not farmers, not big farmers even. They are the buyers of cheap agricultural commodities. They are ADM, Cargill, Coca-Cola, Frito-Lay. Those are the big winners because this kind of farm policy guarantees they can buy their raw materials at less than it costs to produce them. It's a huge giveaway to agribusiness, and we have to keep our mind on that. And these companies and these interests hide behind the farmers who they're supposedly helping. If those companies were forced to pay the real cost of producing these crops, would food prices go up? Yeah, a few pennies. Although, very little of the cost of food is the raw materials at this point. It's all in the processing. So that's who we're giving away all these billions of dollars to. In violation of world trade rules, in violation of ecological principles, and in violation of fairness. But I think that the answer is these are very powerful interests who dump a lot of money on our Congress is getting citizens to write letters to their congressmen, the ones who are not on the Agricultural Committee, because when this bill gets to the floor, that's where the fight will be. And I think we could really surprise that Agricultural Committee and the Bob Etheridges of this world when this gets to the floor of the House.
Let me take one more call. Elizabeth from Niagara-on-the-Lake, Canada. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hi. Beautiful Niagara-on-the-Lake. Great performance at the Shaw last night. Anyway, I lived in Washington, D.C. for 20 years, and then we moved here.
Yeah.
There's a tremendous difference in the prices in the grocery store for poultry and dairy products, all those things that give you all the cholesterol.
You mean it's cheaper in the U.S. than Canada? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, because I moved here from Washington, D.C., and I go into a grocery store in Niagara Falls, Canada, and the prices are 2 and 3 times higher.
But is that good or bad? I mean, people already,
That's great. That's great because people who don't want... Okay, I was tempted by some great cheese the other day, but I went, oh, look at the price of that for brie. But there are dairy and poultry marketing boards in Canada. They set the prices. So the dairy and poultry farmers get much more money for the same egg. I can go across the river to Niagara Falls, New York, and pay, 89 cents a dozen for eggs. Here I pay $2.39.
And you're celebrating that. Elizabeth, our time grows short here. Jake Caldwell, what about that? Are Americans going to be told, change, and you're going to pay through the nose? And are they ready to do that?
Well, I think Niagara-on-the-Lake brings up an important question that we should be discussing in terms of this farm bill and our farm policy in terms of what are some ways that, and Michael alluded to this too, how can we support farmers in a more constructive, more productive way that isn't so trade distorting, that isn't causing us to rely on the subsidies? People have been a little bit critical of the ethanol boom in biofuels, but that has certainly allowed to diversify the income stream for farmers and allowed them to add some value to their product.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully
we'll see more of that.
Hopefully. A lot more to come here, but I guess the bottom line is whether you live in a farm state or not, pay attention. It's your diet and it's your life. Jake Caldwell at the Center for American Progress, thanks for joining us today, Jake.
Thank you, Tom.
And Michael Pollan, you're a real champion in this realm, and we thank you for all your work, your latest book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and great to have you. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.